Well, welcome everyone. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is pleased to host the Southeast Coastal Climate Network's webinar series. Today's webinar is titled Offshore Oil and Gas Exploration, Impacts, Regulation, and Consequences for the Southeast. On behalf of SACE and the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, I'd like to thank you for attending today. It's your interest and support that make our work possible. My name is Erin Cameron, and I'll be the acting facilitator for today's webinar. I'd like to take a moment to review your control panel on your screen. All the lines are muted now and will remain this way throughout the presentation. We ask that if you do have questions, to please chat them in using your control panel, and the questions will be fielded in the order they're received and will be answered at the end of the presentation. All materials for today's presentation will also be available on our website, www.cleanenergy.org. I'd like to now turn the presentation over to Chris Carnival, SACE Coastal Climate and Energy Coordinator.
Thanks, Erin, and thank you, everyone, for attending the webinar today. My name is Chris Carnival, and I'm the manager of the Southeast Coastal Climate Network. As you can see on the current slide, the Southeast Coastal Climate Network is a coalition of individuals and organizations spanning the coastal Southeast who are working on coastal responses to climate change. We have members as far north as Maryland and as far west as Louisiana. The purpose of the network is to bring voices together to trade information and synergize our efforts. The Southeast Coastal Climate Network is hosted under the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Our largest tool is our group site website, which is an online platform that enables members to send group emails, post discussion topics, or relevant news to discussion boards and use a shared group calendar. If you're interested in joining the network and using these tools, please just visit the web address on the screen now, seccn.groupsite.com, and click Join This Group Now. For those of you on the call who are already members, I want to encourage you to use these tools to help get your message out. The purpose of the group is to encourage communication and collaboration, and you have a receptive group of people at your fingertips here. So please don't be shy, and please do use the web tools to your heart's content. Another great tool we have is our webinar series, of which today's webinar is a part. Today we're joined by Michael Jasny from Natural Resources Defense Council to present on American offshore oil and gas exploration, its impacts, and how we can engage in the regulatory process. Michael is a senior policy analyst specializing in the protection of marine mammals and their habitat. As a national expert on ocean noise pollution, he regularly speaks to industry, scientific, and other groups on the issue. He's played a central role in NRDC's ongoing campaign against the proliferation of military sonar, oil and gas exploration, and commercial shipping noise in the oceans, and is working through litigation, lobbying, and public advocacy in both domestic and international forums to improve regulation of this emergent global problem. Michael has also been engaged in developing a U.S. network of marine mammal protected areas, securing protection for endangered marine mammal populations and critical habitat, opposing development projects that threaten marine mammals off the U.S. and Canada, and improving management of fisheries, whale watching, and other sectors under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the nation's leading instrument for the conservation of these species. Michael is the author of several NRDC reports, including Sounding the Depths, Supertankers, Sonar, and the Rise of Undersea Noise, which was the first comprehensive study by an NGO of the ocean noise issue, and has helped lead policy discussion in this area. Further afield, he has also co-authored Drawdown, a report on groundwater depletion on the Hopi and Navajo reservations in northeastern Arizona, and Leap of Faith, a study of Southern California's Natural Communities Conservation Planning Program. He is author or co-author of various publications in legal, policy, and scientific journals. Michael holds a bachelor's degree from Yale College and earned his law degree at Harvard Law School, where he served on the editorial board of the Harvard Human Rights Journal. Following law school, he worked with a White House commission charged with investigating the government's history of human experimentation during the Cold War. He joined the staff of NRDC's Los Angeles office in 2001. With that, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Michael.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks, Erin, and apologies for the long introduction. It's a pleasure to talk with you today, and particularly about this subject. It's of enormous concern, and it's of enormous concern for two reasons. One, because the oil and gas exploration that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has proposed is a precursor and indeed driver of drilling and the exploitation of offshore oil in the Atlantic. But the kind of exploration that BOEM has proposed is also very harmful in its own right. It has enormous impacts on marine mammals and fish and other marine biota, and that's important to know for two reasons. One, because knowing that can be useful to trying to stop this movement toward opening up the East Coast to offshore oil and gas exploration. But it can also be useful as a means of trying to protect habitat from what is very much the pointy end of the spear. I'm going to talk today about air gun exploration, which is the see if I can advance the slide. There we go. Which is the primary technology that's used by the oil and gas industry to prospect for oil and natural gas beneath the seafloor. We're going to talk about what a seismic airgun survey is, what the impacts are on marine mammals and fish and on fisheries, and what BOEM has proposed by way of mitigation, and the kind of compliance process that they're following, or I should say, with respect to both mitigation and regulation and compliance, lack thereof. So to start off, what is a seismic air gun survey? Let's take a step back by first of all looking at the enormous area that would be covered by this activity. The alternatives A and B in the draft environmental impact statement, which was released in May 2012, the comment period is still open, and we'll get to that toward the end of the presentation, would open up the entire Mid-Atlantic and South Atlantic planning areas to exploration over the next 5 years. After that, these areas could be leased for drilling. The Mid-Atlantic planning area runs from the New Jersey-Delaware border all the way down to the border between the Carolinas. The South Atlantic planning area extends south of there down to about midway down the coast of Florida. And it's worth noting, because I find this map to be slightly ambiguous, the planning areas extend all the way to the shore. They exclude state waters, so waters within 3 nautical miles of the coast, but they cover everything from 3 nautical miles out, so it involves the entire South Atlantic and Mid-Atlantic Bight, an enormous area of ocean by any stretch of the imagination. And the amount of activity that's been proposed for this area is also vast. What you're seeing here are just 2 of the 9, although I've now heard that there are 10 proposals that have been initially submitted after then the Minerals Management Service noticed its intent to prepare an EIS for oil and gas exploration in the region. And the looking at those two maps, the areas in green and in red represent the area in which seismic would take place. The amount of time necessary to cover those distances are just enormous, and indeed more than 300,000 track miles have been proposed already, each track mile taking about 20 minutes to complete. So here is the animal in question. It's a seismic air gun vessel. This one is run and managed by Petroleum Geoservices, and we'll be looking closely at the anatomy of this thing in a moment. Here you can see a side view of the seismic vessel, and with it, some kind of visual explanation of exactly how it does what it does. It drags behind it, where you see that little explosive icon, an array of high-powered air guns. That array explodes. The air guns are timed to go off together, and that burst of energy penetrates the seafloor, can go down thousands of feet further and reflects off of rock and other elements beneath the floor. Then the sound goes back up to long strings or streamers of hydrophones, which are underwater microphones. That is all data or grist for the mill. It gets analyzed, and from that, the industry is able to tell where deposits lie beneath the seafloor, how big those deposits are, and so on. One way to look at this is as a massive and highly disruptive and impactful form of ultrasound. It's a similar principle, different kinds of properties in the target area. Here we're going beneath the seafloor, deep into the earth. They reflect sound differently, and it's that difference in the way that sound is reflected that enables industry to tell where oil is at such a distance. Here's a bird's eye view of a seismic survey vessel, and there you see in red two clusters of air gun arrays round about there. From the look of this, it seems like it's probably a 6x3 array, so 18 separate air guns. And then well behind it run these long streamers of microphones. The streamers can run 3 miles or more, so it's a really enormous piece of equipment. And here's another bird's eye view, not a schematic this time, but a photograph. You can see the air guns here, and then the streamers coming out around way back from the boat. So in order to conduct this kind of prospecting, for a sound to run potentially thousands of feet down into the water column and then down potentially thousands of feet below the seafloor, then reflect off of rock and other elements, and then come all the way back through the earth and through the water column, you can imagine that the sound generated has to be pretty powerful, and so it is. A large air gun array injects extremely high pressure sound, greater than 250 decibels, into the ocean. And what I'm about to show you is exactly what that sound looks like visually if you were swimming around an air gun. This is a single air gun suspended in a tank. Have a look. As you can see, it's an explosion. Unlike an explosion, it does not produce shockwaves, but it in all other respects is very, very similar. It uses incredible amounts of sound. Indeed, the sound generated by large air gun arrays is very much like dynamite going off, except in this case, dynamite goes off the explosive charge goes off every 10 to 12 seconds for weeks and months on end. Sorry, just trying to advance the slide. Okay. I'm not sure whether this is going to work, but I will try to play back for you the sound of an air gun so you can hear it as well as see it. This may not work only because I'm not sure what the capacity of webinar is to play back sound, but here we go. You may have been able to hear that through the phone line, if nothing else. The light pinging you hear in the background is the sound of an echo sounder. And indeed, usually seismic is accompanied by lots of other activities as well that also generate a great deal of sound. But the biggest blast by far is from the air guns. By the numbers, again, what we're talking about are extremely powerful devices. if you look at the sound intensity for the various kinds of seismic surveys that are conducted, I won't go into detail about what's the difference between 2D, 3D, and 4D, and so forth. They're very, 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 very loud. They can get up to 255 decibels. And the frequencies that they occupy are broadband. This, like an explosion, the sound isn't concentrated in one particular part of the frequency spectrum. The preponderance of sound is generated in the low frequencies, but indeed there's high levels of sound generated throughout the spectrum. And that means that virtually all marine animals that you can think of would be affected by the sound. Again, let me emphasize to the amount of time that these boats are in the water. Some of these surveys, individual surveys, can take place for up to a year. I want to, just as a side note, I want to differentiate between air gun surveys used for oil and gas exploration and another kind of seismic activity, sub-bottom profiling for renewables. I think it's an important point to make because the draft environmental impact statement folds renewables into the broader consideration of geophysical surveys, kind of a cynical approach that BOEM has taken to try to, I think, confuse matters. Oil and gas exploration, again, involves the use of high-energy air gun arrays, penetrate hundreds or thousands of feet into the water. It involves the use of broadband sound with source levels sometimes greater than 250 decibels. Offshore wind farms, however, use a very different kind of seismic source in order to survey their own areas. They use medium penetration sub-bottom profilers. And because they don't have a need to look very deep under the seafloor, these sub-bottom profilers are relatively benign. I say relatively because they still have some impact, but they don't compare to the use of air guns. The frequencies are more limited. For the Mid-Atlantic, the exemplary sound source that that BOEM has used for analysis runs between 0.5 and 8 kilohertz, so it's more limited, and the source level is orders of magnitude below that of an air gun, 205 decibels versus, again, 250, and that makes a tremendous difference. So what happens to the sound once it gets out there into the water? The important thing to understand is that sound travels extremely far in seawater. It's for this reason and for the lack of visual ability under the waves that marine mammals and other species have evolved to use and rely on sound for virtually everything they need to do to survive and reproduce, for foraging, for breeding, for predator avoidance, for navigation and orientation, for just about everything. The sound of a high-powered air gun can therefore travel very, very far in seawater. You have only to look down here to see just how powerful this can be. These spectrograms were taken on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and the sound that you see visually here represents sound from an air gun activity taking place off the coast of Africa, some 3,000 kilometers away. The other thing to note is that the sound spreads over time. Because sound reverberates, because it takes multiple pathways to reach any single point in the ocean, as you begin to move into these larger distances, that explosive sound of the air gun blast smears over time so that it just pretty much fills up the space, the 10 to 12 second intervals between sounds. And that is, for biological reasons, very important, and we'll get to that in a moment. To give you a sense of just the incredible power of reverberation in the ocean, this is a snapshot of what seismic looks like about 71 seconds after just a single blast. That little dot over there is 71 seconds on, you can see it represented down here below as energy levels peaking 70 seconds in. The sound energy level is still above, and indeed I think slightly above 150 decibels, which is enormous. Because of the nature of seawater, because sounds can travel so far, particularly in the low-frequency sounds, because of these reverberation effects, each of these blasts happening every 10 to 12 seconds have an afterlife that could go on for minutes longer. Okay, so now let's get to the biology. As I was suggesting earlier, whales, fish, sea turtles, just about everything, every marine mammal you can think of in the water falls within the bandwidth of seismic surveys. Much of the energy from seismic surveys is produced within this low frequency band, and that happens to be the same band that is used by many species of whales and fish and others. And as I mentioned, seismic surveys are broadband sound, so animals that hear best above 1 kilohertz would also be significantly affected. Recently, marine mammalogists have got into the habit of talking about acoustic habitat. They look at the soundscape much as you would look at other elements of ocean habitat. And what an air gun array can do to that habitat is very, very significant. Again, because of the way that noise from this kind of powerful source can travel, you can imagine that a single survey can really transform this essential element of habitat for great lengths of time. What we're looking at above on the chart above is a single area. I'm not entirely sure where this was done. Probably the Mid-Atlantic Ridge over the course of about a month and a half or so in 2011. And there you see those red streaks just occupying the frequency spectrum. Those red streaks represent seismic, just completely filling up the habitat over this period of time. Below, you can see what that looks like over the course of a single 24-hour period. So what are the impacts of this transformation of habitat on marine mammals? There are many. There's a potential for stranding and mortality very close to the array. There's a potential for hearing loss and injury. Hearing loss in marine mammals and other species can be fatal because they rely so heavily on hearing for survival. Beyond that, there is an enormous environmental footprint in which a whole range of impacts are caused. These impacts tend to be sublethal, but experienced on a cumulative basis, they can have enormous ramifications for populations of animals. What we're looking at here, again, this is a Mid-Atlantic Ridge. We see here on the left a very large area of ocean. The total area is about 100,000 square miles. These little red dots are, for the most part, fin whales, which are vocalizing in this area and being picked up by hydrophones in the area. On the right, you see the same environment after seismic has moved in. What are the effects? Well, it was found that both humpback and fin whales fell silent within this huge area of ocean. The few male fin whales that continued to vocalize were found to hightail it out of the area, so they were displaced for the length of the survey. And any whale calls that might have been heard within the area were masked. The really remarkable thing is that the seismic survey in question was taking place, let's see if this cursor come up again, right over here, down in this lower right-hand corner of the studied area. And so you can imagine that the sound is also spreading in many, many other directions aside from the one we're looking at. So the scale at which this effect, in which these highly acoustic animals were completely silenced, having impacts on foraging, and displaced, it's enormous. Here's that same area projected over Washington, D.C., just to give a sense of how enormous it is. And I'm going to show you an example of another kind of impact that that seismic causes, and it's been the subject of a great deal of recent concern. And this has to do with masking. Now, masking is often referred to by older male scientists at various conferences as the cocktail chatter effect. You're in a bar. You're trying to speak to somebody. You can't hear them very well because there's lots of sound in the background. And so, as those older male academics will say, you may miss a reproductive opportunity. That's all, you know, very jovial, but for marine mammals, it's very significant. Masking has been studied empirically now in the case of shipping noise. Shipping noise represents a much lower source level of sound, but there are a lot of ships in the sea, and cumulatively they can have a significant effect. There's the most advanced study has been done around the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary, and what I'm going to show you now is what masking looks like visually, what it looks like when animals, in this case endangered North Atlantic right whales, cannot communicate with one another. They can't acoustically see each other in the water. These little firefly lights represent calls of right whales, or sped up over time. And then what we'll see moving in are container ships of various size. And I apologize, by the way, for some reason my computer can't handle this animation very well, and you'll see occasional blackouts. But this will represent 36 hours of life in around Stellwagen Bank for the North Atlantic right whale. Here we go. That sun in the horizon, that big floodlight, is a large container vessel moving in. It completely obliterates the right whale calls. And if we can't see the right whale calls in this animation, the right whales can't hear each other. So how loud are these ships compared to seismic? Well, these ships are probably on the order of 185, 190 decibels at their source. Seismic, again, we're talking 230 to upwards of 250, 255 decibels. And each 10 decibel increase on the represents an entire order of magnitude gain because decibels are logarithmic. So it's a huge, huge difference of what seismic can do versus what we've just seen. There has been some recent work to model masking effects from seismic. Here what we're looking at is omnidirectional sound energy levels from a single seismic air gun off the north slope of Alaska. You could tell that this is a very large area. They didn't even model beyond four degrees of latitude away, and still you can see that the sound is over 120 decibels in much of this area. So what's the effect of that as it's been modeled on various species? Well, it has different effects on different animals depending on how they vocalize and other things. But the work that's been done indicates that for right whales in particular, and again, that right whales are a very significant concern for the East Coast, masking approaches 100% for the entire duration of these activities. I'm going to talk about some other studies just to give you an illustration. I mean, this is actually a fairly robust literature. There's a lot that needs to be investigated, God knows, particularly when it comes to population level impacts, but there's been a lot of work demonstrating impacts of seismic and other sources on vital behavior in marine mammals. So this is just one or two more snapshots of that. This is a study done on sperm whales in the Gulf of Mexico. The finding, well, I should say, sperm whales were tagged by investigators. These tags are able to capture information about what the animal's doing in the water, how it's diving, how it's rolling, what it's hearing, and so on. And then after they were tagged, the sperm whales were exposed briefly to seismic noise. And what they found is that the noise that sperm whales make when they capture prey, it's called a buzz, and it represents a successful lunge at prey, fell off significantly when seismic was in the area. Indeed, it decreased substantially, 20% on average, even at what were pretty low levels of exposure. So in this case, you have an animal that did not abandon its habitat, and for good reason, because the area in which the researchers went in the Gulf of Mexico represents an important nursery for sperm whales. But they did see that the sperm whales lost a significant amount of their prey while seismic was taking place, and again, even at low levels of exposure that they could be experiencing almost chronically. Now I'm going to turn to fish. Like marine mammals, fish rely on sound for a great deal. They live in a world of sound. They hear using ears that are similar to those in other vertebrates. They're very sensitive to low frequency sound. Again, seismic air gun surveys have the preponderance of their energy concentrated in the low frequencies, though they're broadband. And tellingly, there are no examples of deaf fish, which says something about the importance of hearing for these creatures. Like marine mammals, they use hearing for many, many things. Many stocks produce sounds in spawning aggregations like drumfish, which are important for the East Coast and many other species. And they're major contributors to their acoustic environments. Just to give you an image, this is some of the sounds that drumfish and toadfish make. Because black drumfish produce sound in the low frequencies, you could see that all of the bands that they're using fall below about 300 hertz. They can be very easily masked by seismic, and indeed, there's been some work showing that not only that seismic masks black drum chorusing, but also disrupts it. It causes the fish to stop chorusing as well. And that's very significant because black drum fish use chorusing as an essential element of their breeding. So what are the population level effects on fish? There's been very little study of it, but there's potential for significant population level effects on at least some species. I also want to mention the research that's been done on direct impacts of seismic on fisheries. For years, fishermen in various parts of the world have complained about loss in their catch when seismic moves in. And because of that, there have been a number of controlled studies undertaken by Norway and government of Norway and by others to determine how true this is. So what I'm going to show you briefly is one of those Norwegian studies. They took place in this experimental area here off the coast of Norway. There was a seismic air gun positioned in the middle of a study area that was roughly—it's actually even larger than 40 nautical miles in size. It extended outwards about 20 nautical miles in each direction from the boundaries of the seismic survey. But here, what you're seeing is the acoustic densities of two species, cod and haddock, before shooting, during shooting, and after shooting in an area that is 40 nautical miles in diameter with the seismic survey at the center. And you can see by this transition from red to yellow to green, significant falling off in density. And that's because of displacement of the fish both vertically and horizontally. This had ramifications on catch rates. In this bar chart, you can see trawl catch rates of cod and haddock I think cods on top, haddocks on the bottom, before, during, and after seismic. And these relatively low catch rates persisted for 5 days, at least 5 days. That was the end of the study period after the seismic had ceased. Not all commercial fish have been shown to react in a way that, that reduces catch rates, but the majority of them have. So there are potentially very significant implications for commercial and recreational fisheries off the East Coast. I realize I want to make sure I've got time for questions, so I'll just move through the next few slides quickly. Just to mention, there have been a lot to find out about fish, but still there are studies indicating, as for marine mammals, that seismic can have a whole variety of impacts. The long-term consequences of seismic surveys on fish populations is not known, but should be of great concern. So what does BOEM say to all of this in the DEIS that was released a couple of months ago? Well, according to BOEM's own estimates, seismic exploration would injure up to 138,500 marine mammals and disrupt important marine mammal activity, feeding, calving, breeding, more than 13.5 million times. Those are very large numbers, and they're very concerning. That said, the overall take numbers are based on a threshold of 160 decibels. I won't go into detail about this. I'm happy to answer questions about it, but the number is has been challenged by the leading bioacousticians in the field as being scientifically outdated and incorrect. It's based on state of knowledge 15 years ago, and not even that. It was actually misread based on the existing literature then, and has since been outstripped by a great deal of literature that indicates that that number is artificially high. BOEM admits that all of these impacts can have cumulative effects at the population level, but then BOEM does nothing to assess these cumulative impacts on fish or marine mammals. And then finally, they provide three alternatives. Alternative C would bar seismic for oil and gas exploration, but allow that much lower level of geophysical activity for renewables. That's the alternative certainly that NRDC supports. Alternatives A and B, however, would pretty much open the floodgates to seismic across an entire region we discussed with grossly inadequate mitigation. This is where I'm going to try to go into fast mode. Suffice it to say that the mitigation that's been prescribed is very poor. It's been called by courts in other cases, in other contexts, grossly inadequate and ineffectual. This involves, for example, monitoring small areas of ocean around seismic vessels to try to reduce injuries to animals. It has limited efficacy given the difficulties of visual observation and the fact that it does nothing for impacts beyond this very small area around the boat. There are similar problems with something called ramp up. That's a mitigation measure wherein operators slowly increase the sound of their air guns. They bring their air guns online slowly for purposes of warning animals away. But it's clear that some animals, like the sperm whales we saw earlier, will not abandon important habitat. They'll stay even though the insonification of their habitat could be physically harmful or could undermine their fitness. BOEM did propose time area closures, which are a very good thing. That is potentially an effective means of mitigation. They've done it really to protect North Atlantic right whales. For those of you who don't know the right whale, it's probably the marine mammal species of greatest concern. On the East Coast, there are only about 400 of these animals left. They haven't recovered from whaling. Their calving interval is much longer than their cousin species, the southern right whale. It's been thought increasingly that they're calving less because of lots of noise, particularly shipping noise, off the East Coast. And according to NIMS, the loss of even a single reproductive female can jeopardize the survival of the species. BOEM has proposed a couple of different degrees of time area for closures for North Atlantic right whale, which again is good. except that the closures are deficient. Operators could use seismic at the very edge of right whale critical habitat, even within the only known calving grounds of the right whale, even under the alternatives that have been proposed. And it's not clear whether this measure would appreciably reduce the masking effects that we discussed earlier, because those effects occur many, many miles away from the seismic source. Additionally, no time area closures have been proposed for other marine mammal populations or for fish, and BOEM didn't even try to identify important habitat for marine mammals in the region. This is something I'll, in the interest of time, I'll skip over, but suffice to say that there are some alternative technologies for seismic on the horizon that are still impactful, but are potentially significantly less impactful than air guns. The most interesting of these for the intermediate term is vibrosize. It uses vibrations rather than big booms in order to produce the sound. And that has benefits in a number of ways. Much lower source levels and a more controlled frequency, so it could effectively eliminate impacts on most but not all marine mammals. This is a technology in development. It probably won't be ready for another, there's already one vibrosize array that's available for commercial deployment, but it probably won't be available on a significant scale for several years. It begs the question, however, of why this activity is taking place now, when in 5 years there could be a commercially viable means of at least reducing the harm to many marine mammal species and many species of fish. And yet the DEIS does not include even identify any action alternatives for the development and application of vibrosize and other potential alternative technologies. The last point I want to make is that effects are cumulative, yet permitting is taking place on a survey-by-survey basis under what BOEM has proposed. Again, we're talking about an enormous amount of seismic activity. In addition to that, after seismic will come drilling. This is the Gulf of Mexico, which probably over represents what the drilling might be like in the East Coast, but still, just one of these undersea platforms can have an enormous disruptive presence in the oceans. Just one of these hubs can stretch across an enormous area. This is the Independence Hub superimposed on Eugene, Oregon, where I gave a presentation some time ago. So between seismic and drilling and everything else concerned with oil and gas exploration, enormous cumulative impacts just from the noise over time on a variety of species. In the Gulf of Mexico, the agencies are pursuing programmatic permitting under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, programmatic consultation under the Endangered Species Act. For the Atlantic, the permitting would be piecemeal. Yes, there's this nice NEPA process that's programmatic, albeit with an extremely deficient draft EIS. But when it comes time for MMPA review, Marine Mammal Protection Act review, Endangered Species Act review, the agencies will have this taking place on a survey-by-survey basis. NIMS isn't happy with this. It wants to proceed programmatically. BOEM is unwilling, and the reason BOEM is unwilling is utterly transparent. They are concerned that they will not be able to meet MMPA standards and ESA standards of impact if they proceed cumulatively rather than survey-by-survey. In other words, they hope to segment the analysis to get out from under the negligible impact and small numbers thresholds in MMPA and the jeopardy and adverse modifications limits under the Endangered Species Act. So in summary, just some highlights and take-homes, and this is probably the most important one. Seismic exploration is not only the immediate precursor and driver of drilling, it itself has significant environmental impacts. Given the nature of seismic exploration, these impacts will occur over very large scales, ecoregional in size, over time and space. It's important to understand that the ocean is an acoustic world. Marine mammals and fish and other species use sound for just about everything they do in the ocean. And yet, no studies have been undertaken to estimate population-level impacts or impacts to fisheries by BOEM. And indeed, proceeding through a permitting process and consultation process under MMPA and ESA that would avoid assessment of population level impact. So please send comments by July 2nd. We're going to have a petition drive after that, too, and it would be great to have everybody's help, both in getting comments and to BOEM on the DEIS and in generally making lots of noise about this very terrible plan. And now I'm very happy to take questions.
Thank you so much, Michael. We do have a few questions here. The first one, how does the noise level of seismic exploration compare to the noise level of normal shipping activities?
I did touch on that a little bit in the presentation. So large container vessels produce noise around 180 to 190 decibels. Tankers, super tankers, produce noise around 190 decibels. Compare that to seismic, a small seismic array will produce noise at around 230 decibels, a large one noise above 250 decibels. As I mentioned earlier, each 10 decibel increase is an increase of an order of magnitude in the intensity of the sound. And that means that sound from seismic propagates much further at higher levels than does noise from ships. One last thing I'd add is that all of this is cumulative, of course. So shipping has already degraded the acoustic environment of the East Coast. Again, it's why a lot of people in the scientific community believe the right whale calving intervals are so long, and essentially why the right whale hasn't recovered. And seismic would be added to that, superimposed on what is already a degraded ocean habitat. That only adds to the problem.
Okay. Another question. What's the legal recourse if BOEM goes ahead with the plan as is?
Well, the obvious legal recourse is litigation. The DEIS, we think is inadequate in its alternatives analysis and its impact analysis. The continued use of 160 decibels, for example, is just patently wrong. And while it's hard to challenge agencies on matters of science, this is actually I think it's a pretty darn good issue. And then under the Marine Mammal Protection Act and Endangered Species Act, we'll have to see exactly how they proceed. But given the way that BOEM has handled things so far, and that NMFS has handled other authorization processes for the Navy and others, it wouldn't surprise me if there aren't some very significant issues emerging out of their MMPA and ESA review. So I think there's some significant potential for litigation down the line if the agencies don't do the right thing, which is unfortunately likely.
Okay, another question. Peru recently lost many dolphins attributed to acoustic pollution from oil and gas exploration. Is it likely that would happen in the American Atlantic coast as well?
I think Peru is very murky. I haven't seen any. I know the way it's been reported is that seismic was probably responsible, and then maybe sonar was responsible. I haven't seen any evidence yet that really indicates one way or another whether acoustics was responsible for those mass mortalities in Peru. However, there have been strandings associated with seismic in other areas. In Madagascar, for example, large numbers of melon-headed whales died off Baja California. Some beaked whales died. So seismic can certainly cause strandings. I would say though that by far the biggest concern are the impacts that we don't see, the impacts that are occurring at sea, hearing loss, which can be fatal to animals, near-source injury, and, of course, the vast number of sublethal impacts, significant impacts or takes that that even Boehm is projecting would occur to just about every marine mammal species off our coast.
Okay, we have another question here. Are shrimpers significantly affected by oil and gas exploration?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the answer to that is from what we've seen, yes. There's been some work done on the effects on shrimp, and the indications anyway is that shrimp are displaced by the seismic activity noise. There hasn't been any work that I've seen on impacts on catch rates, but given the kind of displacement we've seen in other species and fish species and the impacts on catch rates of those species, there's a very significant potential for impact. I would add that squid fall into the same category. There's been work showing displacement of squid, and even actually a really interesting set of events in the Bay of Biscay showing giant squid, which are very seldom seen, God knows, coming up onto shore dead in tight correlation with seismic surveys, and indeed demonstrating a kind of physical injury that you would expect from a loud source of pressure. So, aside from marine mammals and fish, many other marine biota are potentially affected, and the fisheries and livelihoods that depend on them.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question. Let's see. How much noise pollution does the process of actually drilling the wells cause? Is it significant compared to the exploration process?
Yeah, another really good question. It's a lot less significant. The drilling noise generates sound below 200 decibels. However, with drilling, you have to consider that it can occur in discrete areas over lengths of time. So if a particular habitat area is of importance to an animal, the presence of a drilling rig can exclude the animal from that habitat for a while. In addition, there are other sound sources used in exploration and production that add to the din. There are stabilizers used on some floating rigs. They generate a great deal of noise. I've never seen specs published on them, but industry folks who you talk to begin to get very nervous when you start mentioning it, because I think it's recognized that it's a very powerful noise source. In addition, when rigs are decommissioned, at least in the Gulf of Mexico, they have been blown up, and the use of explosives, of course, poses not only an acoustic risk but also a risk of direct injury to marine mammals and other species. So, really, we're talking about an activity that, from cradle to grave, has enormous impacts. And again, I can't emphasize this enough. These are impacts beyond the risk from oil spill. These are impacts that are taking place on a daily basis once oil and gas exploration starts.
Thank you so much, Michael, for being with us today and for sharing all of this information. And thank you, attendees, for the questions and for being with us as well. I'm going to actually see if Chris would like to chime in about a link that is on our closing slide that we will show here in 1 second.
Thanks, Michael. Great presentation. You gave us a lot of information to work with, so thank you very much. As Michael mentioned, and on that last slide, you saw that Boehm is taking comments until July 2nd. So, you know, we want to strongly encourage everybody who is, you know, worried about this process to go ahead and submit comments to BOEM. We've set up some sample letters that you can access and send extremely easily with just a few clicks. Go to the link that you'll see towards the bottom of the page that's up right now. It's just simply bit.ly/don't drill. bit.ly/don't drill. It takes just a few clicks to submit some comments to BOEM from there, or if you want to formulate your own letter, you can do so on our webpage from cleanenergy.org. Also, feel free to be in touch with me or Michael if you have any questions or want to follow up with any information. Another announcement I wanted to let you all know about is that Hands Across the Sand will be taking place on August 4th. Hands Across the Sand is an international day of action to demonstrate people's opposition to offshore drilling and to show their support for clean energy. This is the third year that Hands Across the Sand has happened. And in the prior 2 years, there have been thousands of demonstrations in all 50 states and over 40 countries around the world. So this is a great opportunity, a fantastic opportunity for elevating this issue in the public spotlight, for getting the media involved, et cetera. Please log on to handsacrossthesand.com to find a demonstration site near you. Or to organize your own. Again, that's handsacrossthesand.com. And with that, I think we are ready to conclude the webinar. Thank you, everybody.
Great. Thanks, Chris. And thanks, everybody, for attending today's Southeast Coastal Climate Network webinar. SACE is very excited to take part in this webinar series. We'd like to thank all of our members on this call and encourage those of you who are not members to join us today. For more information, please check out our website, www.cleanenergy.org. I encourage you to also view our blog or follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Again, today's presentation will be available on our webinar archive page of our website. Have a great day.